All right. Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. Go around and say hi to Marv and Tyler, Mark T, John. I don't know, John without a last name. there's another John. Bob K. John G, Paul, Shoketsu, Bob O, Mark C, Joan, Drew, Gathel, Susan, Jeff, Jim, Franklin, Jill, Yeshizoki, Bridget, and Ruth Ann. All right. The only thing on our calendar that's somewhat unusual is a possible in-person picnic this Saturday from 2 to 4 in Cedar Hills Park. So let's see. We can hope, right? We can hope that the smoke is gone by then. If not, we will cancel. So stay tuned. Crazy times. Any other announcements I should make? Is book group happening soon? Somebody want to?
Yeah, book club is this Saturday. 10.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that means our Sangha meeting will be shorter, although I do actually have another Zoom we could use. So we'll figure that out. All right. Another announcement. I did look at as I was preparing today and I thought, chapter 12, we only have a couple more weeks left on this book. So I meant to bring the book so I could lift it up and show you, but our next book will be Norman Fisher's relatively new book called The World Could Be Otherwise. And it's about the six paramitas, but in particular through a frame of how to hold the precepts in the modern world. So it's a really beautiful, book. I will send that the name of that in the chat. Not normal, Norman Fisher. And I'll this will be in the newsletter as well. But I think it'll be a really sweet book. And in the conversation before we started this evening, Ruth Ann was talking a little bit about imagination. And the first chapter in this book is not on a paramita, it's on the importance of imagination. So it's very, very sweet. Chapter 12 on life force and life activity. So as some of you may not know, this book, How to Cook Your Life from the Zen Kitchen to Enlightenment, we've been working through it. We're on chapter 12 out of 14. It's focused on the text by Dogen, he's in 1200, so that's the 13th century Soto Zen master in Japan, author of a lot of texts that we use in Soto Zen. And so this is focused on his text, the Tenzo Kyokun, or Instructions for the Head Cook of the Monastery. So this is an important role, and the text has a lot of very specific advice. You know, wake up at this time, consult with these people, cook the food like this. But then it also has woven into it just like the spirit that the Tenzo is supposed to have, and it has actually a lot of deep Zen teachings in it, and it's easily applied to work of any kind. And not just, you know, kind of formal paid work, but the work that we do just to take care of our lives, take care of our responsibilities, take care of our homes, essential essence. So let's see. So specifically in this chapter, he's dealing with interaction that took place between him, Dogen, and in the Tenzo Kyokan. This is the section that Uchiyama is focusing on, where Dogen has traveled to China and he ends up having an interaction with a couple different Tenzos, a couple different cooks, head cooks over there. And in particular, this one, he's on a ship. He has arrived and he hasn't been able to get off yet. And a Tenzo ends up on the ship to buy some mushrooms, and he gets in a conversation with him about practice, and he wants the Tenzo to stick around so they can talk Dharma longer. But the Tenzo says, I have to get back. I've walked 14 miles to get these mushrooms, and now he's got to go walk 14 miles to get back in order to make the meal. And he's an older man, so Dogen says, you know, why are you spending your time, you know, cooking and, you know, walking to get mushrooms and all of that? He says, why, when you are so old, do you do the hard work of a Tenzo? Why do you not spend your time practicing Zazen or working on the koans of former teachers? Is there something special to be gained from particularly working as a Tenzo? So the Tenzo bursts out laughing and says, my good friend from abroad, you do not yet understand what practice is all about. Nor do you know the meaning of characters. So in characters, this is one of those things where sometimes the Dharma teaching seems very obtuse, but there is actually just a simple explanation. In this case, characters means words, because, you know, Japanese and Chinese, character is a word. So it's basically just referring to the words of the ancient masters or the teachings. So you do not yet understand the teachings if you think I should be doing Zazen or studying koans instead of working as the Tenzo. So then some time passes, the Tenzo goes back and they encounter each other again. So the part of the interaction that this chapter, Uchiyama's chapter, is focusing on is when Dogen gets a chance to ask this Tenzo again, what are characters? What is the meaning of the teaching? What is the meaning of the characters? And the Tenzo replies, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Again, kind of obtuse, but Uchiyama helps us by saying that it means everything. So Dogen asks, what is practice? And the Tenzo says, there is nothing in the world that is hidden, or everything in your life is practice. So Dogen really, you know, he starts off in Japan. He's studied Buddhism for many, many years before he goes to China. He studies in the Tendai tradition, which is very, I don't know that much about it, but it is focused on scriptures and ritual and study and that kind of stuff. So that's the kind of Buddhism that Dogen was trained in, and actually then became dissatisfied with, right? That's why he went to China, because he felt like his deepest questions hadn't been answered. So he goes to China, and one of the main things that he encounters is and writes about are these Tenzos that impress upon him that it's, you know, your work, it's your everyday activity that is the essence of practice. Yes, we sit Zazen, but that is in a way just to provide context. So then Uchiyama introduces another unless it happens. Oh, okay. In the Tenzo Kyokan, Dogen introduces this poem, the Gata of Zuedo. Another Zen master of some kind. And he says, 1735, the truth you search for cannot be grasped. As night advances, a bright moon illuminates the whole ocean. The dragon's jewels are found in every wave. Looking for the moon, it is here, in this wave, in the next. So the moon, often in Chinese poetry and Chan, symbolizes enlightenment. The truth that you search for cannot be grasped, and the bright moon illuminates the whole ocean. So where do you, it's reflected on every wave. So where do you encounter enlightenment? It's every wave. This wave, then the next, you can't grasp it. It just appears, then it appears again. And the 1735, he says, refers to a form of poetry that kind of suggests nothing is constant. So his takeaway message from all of this is, in living this life day by day, in which anything might happen, we search for some absolute truth. But no matter how hard we try, we never seem to be able to fix on anything solid that could be labeled truth. The passage in the Gata, "it cannot be grasped," means that no matter how deep we search for something absolute to cling to, we will never find it. There is always that part of ourselves that wants to put its finger directly on some final universal truth. And life is just not that simple. So, when I was reflecting on this, I was thinking about how this may always be the case, but it seems particularly upfront right now, that I think most of our lives are turning out much differently than we expected or wanted. And of course, there may be things in our personal lives that applies to, things that have changed, shifts in our personal life, shifts in our employment, changes in financial situations, relationships, health, things that, just not what we expected. And then certainly things around us, wildfires, climate change, hurricanes, racial unrest, facing the possibility of an election that might result in civil unrest. And this is not how I expected things to go, not how I wanted things to go. So our minds evolved to try to make sense of things for us. They evolved to come up with some kind of theories or understanding that will let us predict what we should do, let us make good decisions and protect ourselves and our loved ones. I mean, you know, there's a reason why our mind works overtime, trying to process or, you know, push away, make sense of things. So we create narratives about ourselves, the kind of person we are, the kind of priorities we have, the things we like, the things that we're willing to accept and the things that we're not willing to accept, about our personality, our strengths, our weaknesses, hopes, responsibilities, plans. We create narratives about our lives. What's worked, what hasn't worked, what's been disappointing, what's been rewarding, what we want to keep going, what we want to stop. our fortunes and misfortunes, the situations we feel responsible for, and how we're going to take care of them, how we're going to juggle the demands on our time and energy, how we want to spend our money and resources. We create narratives about our relationships, the people that we want to be intimate with, more intimate with, less intimate with, relationships that are working, the relationships that are not. Thoughts about how we should maintain, you know, how do we maintain our connections? How much priority do we give to spouse, family, friends, other aspects of our lives? We create narratives about the larger world. What's good, what's bad, how things are likely to turn out, which aspects of the world are relevant to us and which aren't, which aspects we feel some responsibility for, and the things that are outside of our realm of responsibility. Who's to blame for the awful scenarios, and what should be done about them? So all of this is what Uchiyama talks about as being a fabrication of our minds. So on page 85, he says, above everything else, the spirit running through the text of the Tenzo Kyokan is clearly that of functioning with a clear mind and true sincerity in the actual situation in which we find ourselves, and not in the one we have merely fabricated in our minds. So he compares the aspects of our mind that do this fabrication, Dogen actually says, if you both day and night allow all things to come into and reside within your mind, allow your mind or yourself and all things to function together as a whole, he says, this will happen. This can happen naturally. Yet we remain unclear because our minds go racing about like horses running wild in the fields, while our emotions remain unmanageable like monkeys swinging in the trees. If only we would step back to carefully reflect on horse and monkey, our lives would naturally become one with our work. So, wanted to spend some time exploring what this really means. Let me just so I really was struck by that. That phrase, that sentence. If we only would step back to carefully reflect on our horse and monkey, we would naturally become one with our work. And actually, I decided to kind of stick two of the sentences together. So kind of the meaning of this, to step back and carefully reflect on the horse and monkey, and then naturally our mind, or he says the mind meaning the self with a capital S, and all things will function together as a whole. So I guess we reflect on what this really actually means in our experience. stepping back to carefully reflect on this busy mind. You know, what does it mean to step back? What does it mean to reflect on this mind of ours that keeps trying to create narratives and plans and whatever to help protect us, help take care of us? But it also means that we're just our minds are running all over, right? Like the horse running wild and the monkey swinging through the trees. And if we do this kind of reflection, naturally our self and all things will function together as a whole. And I think we've talked about this in quite a few previous weeks, because this is like one of the main points that Uchiyama takes out of the Tenzo Kyokan, is this sense of everything that we encounter being our life, and that when we are fully engaged in our lives and we're fully present, there's something that works, there's something coherent about it. So we've explored that a number of times. So in terms of stepping back, when we notice that, you know, we're engaged in all those activities I was talking about, trying to make sense of things, creating narratives about ourselves, our lives, the world, our relationships, I guess, just please unmute yourself and say something if you can think of, you know, what does it mean to step back? Go ahead, Joan.
I think to me it means letting go. So, because, you know, when you have these thoughts in your mind, these stories you're creating, these emotions, to me that's like getting things stirred up. And if you let go of all of those things, then they would just float down and you would be left with what's really going on, not these things that you're creating and feeling. So I think letting go is the big thing for me.
Mm. I like that image of the, you're stirring stuff up. And if you just let it be, it will settle.
It'll settle, yeah.
Other thoughts on stepping back?
Does it give like a change, like giving yourself a change of perspective almost? Like allowing to see I don't want to jump to reflect, allowing you to see a bigger picture or something if you step back or something like that. You don't get so narrowly focused.
Ruth Ann?
I think it was mentioned in the last discussion after or during Dharma talk that it's another way of saying that is get out of your own way, you know, let your creative stop trying to control, which is reflecting what Joan and Tyler said as well.
Yeah, because even though we have to do some sense making and some planning, there's very little we can actually control.
Can I speak? For myself, I've had to grapple all my life with adult autism. And, you know, I can get incredibly focused and obsessive. And in group work, not tuned into sometimes how rude I can be or how I think what's going on is not what the group thinks is going on. So, you know, I've had to, you know, I'm with a psychiatrist once a month on all this, and it's been a lifetime thing for me. And, you know, it's, for me, it's stepping back from my own, to actually observe, to learn to observe others and to learn to interpret and see how others are seeing the world and me, and trying to get a bigger view of me, not in a selfish way, but so that I can function, you know, so that I see myself as others see me and modify my behaviors. And particularly when in loose things, like I was an ambulance paramedic for years, and I was always good with empathy in close, you know, in close functions, say with a patient or something. But outside in more complex tasks, I'd break down and just go into my own world. Anyway, I've spoken too much. It's a very personal thing for me. This.
Yeah.
I'm as a lifetime autistic person, so.
Stepping outside of one's own
way of
perceiving, which I mean, in a way, is very difficult to do, but
yes,
or at least questioning, right? At least questioning our own perceptions.
Yes, particularly when empathy and capacity to read other emotions doesn't come as naturally as does to others.
Anything else on stepping back?
I think this is just kind of restating in different language what some of you have touched on, but I think stepping back, we can see a greater context. Everything happens in context, and oftentimes we become really focused on our place and the context as it relates to us. And if we step back, we can actually get a better idea of the whole context and our place in it, and other people's place in it, and the relationships and such. I mean, like Mark, I find sometimes I get so involved in the task at hand that I can be rude to other people because that task at hand takes on an importance above their task. And stepping back and seeing that, you know, the context of this, that task is important to me, their task is important to them, and being aware of that and working with that.
I like it.
Yeah, another way to put some of this is calling it reframing. I spent the past week class on reframing racism. So looking at it from other people's perspectives.
And part of that process of reframing, right, is also becoming aware of the frames that you are using.
That you use for yourself, yeah.
You think you're just looking at things objectively. But so, once we have stepped back, yes, what does it mean to carefully reflect?
One thing that came to me actually more when Gatha was talking as a real image, but also as more like a gestalt role play, to see that I am initially standing as if I am the center of the world. I am the center of the universe. I'm the center of the circle. And literally set that up as a role play and walk to the rim of the circle and literally look left, right, up, down, and across at every other spoke on that rim of the circle with my mouth closed and listen so that there isn't any one particular holding the center. We're all holding the rim and that creates the center. But I would, for me, I would probably actually act that out as in a role play. And then the reflection part for me would be to initially start with just listening to the other points on the rim. Not just both directions, it's all directions. Endless directions on the rim of the circle.
I like that sense of opening up the perceptions. It's like where that narrative is so much content generation, and to actually go into a different mode of receiving.
Listening to understand, as opposed to just listening to be polite, but listening to truly understand what the other is saying.
And I think this process is not necessarily a rational thing. It's a sort of, you need to just stew, you know, particularly when you're involving reframing and opening to others, the reflection is really just kind of bearing witness and just stewing in it for a while. Because you just can't automatically move into another frame, you know. It's a skillful act that takes not meditation, but it's kind of contemplation and living it. Difficult.
I think you can also even role play the body language of the other person to get a sense of how their thoughts embody and how their embodiment affects their thoughts.
Following up on my letting go thing, I think for me it would be just looking at all the things that come up and say, is this really true? So finding the truth.
How do you know it's true? What evidence do you have?
Well, you know, so I think that's where you're determining, is this my narrative, or is this what's really happening? You know, taking away all those things that you've created yourself.
So what about then when we turn this, we step back and we turn this careful reflection on our own horse and monkey. So that's what he said. We step back and carefully reflect on this runaway horse and this monkey swinging through the trees, our thoughts and emotions busily trying to make sense of things and look out for us. So what does it mean to reflect on those?
I think that we're looking into what is driving these thoughts and emotions. You know, are they out of greed, or, you know, what is driving them? So you kind of know what's what's moving you, and you can get to the bottom of that and just understand that, I guess.
And what about I'm just wondering about the reflection that people were talking about in terms of this real opening the perceptions and, you know, listening, perceiving in kind of a really open way. Go ahead, Mark.
Well, I guess I spent a lot of years within the Joko Beck School of Ordinary Mind Zen, and we had a practice there of, which is really Theravadan, of labeling thoughts as they arose, just as a technique to learn to observe, because so often the thought and narrative is actually subconscious. Mm-hmm. And also there's that thing of the effective aspect of perception. I know, watching how your aversive or attractiveness to perception arises with the thought. I think it's a long practice of learning to, it's an active way of turning the torch inwards. Yeah. And a kind of just watching yourself and learning. To look at yourself as you act and see and label the thoughts as they arise and see your own reactivity.
Like it.
Difficult.
I think for me, if I fearlessly embrace whatever arises, even if I think it's not quote unquote acceptable or polite or nice, or maybe it's so sweet and so nice, just whatever it is, but I just fearlessly accept it. Whatever that monkey or that horse is, just kind of dissipates. It doesn't hang out like this smoke does. It just becomes a wispy cloud and dissipates and reveals to me what was really driving that need or that expression to begin with. But when I don't embrace it for whatever reason I might have, then the monkey and the horse win.
I find it very encouraging that he's not saying we need to banish the horse and the monkey or get them under control. I find that very encouraging, because I've never been able to get my horse or monkey under control. So if the practice required that, then I would be a failure. So the fact that there's something else going on. So what about, so then if we do this, then naturally self and all things function together as a whole. But first I wanted to just visit that naturally part. Just, I find that a very important word, that if we do this, then naturally this result follows of being one with our work, one with our life. Does it mean to say it happens naturally?
This kind of follows on what was just said, but it seems like just once we have like awareness of that thought or emotional content, the the content kind of stops. I mean, you have that bodily experience that accompanies it that's still there, but the storyline kind of stops on its own through just this, not because you force it to, but just because you're aware of it now, and it kind of dissipates on its own, to use that word. And, you know, not because you force it to, just because you've become aware of it.
I think the same thing. When I meditate on a thought, I realize, oh, this really isn't anything but fluff. And then it just fluffs away. The only way I could compare it again is like a candle smoke or a cloud that it's just there and it's gone. To me, naturally, it just goes. Didn't really have any substance to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Take a bit of time, though. The naturally doesn't mean instantly. I remember one time I was really having this major brawl at work, and my emotions were all negative emotions targeted on this one person. And I went to a 3-day retreat, the Zenkai, a sort of a 3-day session. And I just sat there stewing and watching. I couldn't just watch thoughts for days. And then on the third day, the lovely result of this, the third day, the volume just went down and left and left and left. And I just released these negative thoughts about this guy. It was lovely at work. But it took 3 days. So, yes, it does happen naturally, but it doesn't mean naturally doesn't mean instantly.
I think it means also kind of it's an indirect and hands-off kind of way, because you don't subdue it. I mean, if you try to subdue it, that's just more mental content. It's just tying the web tighter or something. But yeah, I appreciate what you're saying, that knot sometimes can take a little while to untie itself.
Yeah, and if you think of nature is non-human, it doesn't involve, natural is something that doesn't involve human, you know, manipulation and intervention. And I guess it feels to me like, you know, the problem is caused by our, like, grasping on to stuff. And if we can let go, like, things settle down naturally, or things flow naturally, or things, it's the getting in the way that's the problem. And if we can stop doing that, we let the natural process take over. Just some of those, one of the things I just love so much about Zazen. So I'm going to leave the exactly what the mind and self and all things functioning together as a whole means, because I think we've talked about that some.
Can I just add something quick?
Yeah.
What you just said, maybe just think of like a natural ecosystem, like when they remove the wolves from Yellowstone, how all the ruminant population exploded, and then they were all getting diseased and sick. And then it was being overgrazed, and everything was upside down in a mess. And then they brought the wolves back, and they reestablished the natural balance of prey and predator, and the vegetation returned naturally.
Yeah, I like that. Restore, that's what Zazen is about, right? It's trying to let things settle down and restore the natural balance. So there's another really meaty section that I wanted to invite us to explore as smaller groups. And I'm hoping that that once I put something in the chat, that even when you're in the breakout room, you can see what I've already put in the chat. That's my going theory. So this is what I'm gonna, the sentence So he says on page 85, practicing the way of the Buddha means to actually put our bodies to work, vividly living in every moment of our lives. So I wanted to ask, based on your own experience, what does it mean to vividly live in a given moment? So vivid, I looked it up as a word. I mean, full of life, lively, animated. Synonyms include expressive, dynamic, vigorous, lucid, spirited, distinct. So how do you know if you're living vividly? What is the opposite of vividly living? So you don't have to answer all of those questions or anything, but just whatever one kind of makes you curious. Somebody in the group, just have it in your head that you're going to come back as spokesperson and share a couple things. So designate your spokesperson. I'm going to recreate, and well, let's see. We're going to do. Okay. There we go. Randomly assigned. So. Spokespeople, do you want to say a couple words about what you heard?
I'll share. So for me, I think I right now have a vow of right speech. And so for me, vividly living would be practicing right speech and recognizing when I'm getting off on a tangent and, you know, not, you know, getting out of touch with things. So that would be vividly living for me. Being present, some other people said being present and in the moment versus the opposite would be, you know, in the past or the future or involved in some storyline. Another person shared that, you know, if they notice themselves getting upset, that's a flag to return to the moment. So those are some of the things we talked about.
Living vividly, that's kind of a hard concept to grasp. I talked about noting that a lot of the Tibetan Buddhists seem to be very joyful. But then, and you know, we talked about being joyful and then washing the dishes. That seems to be an example that comes up a lot. But then it's like, well, what happens when it, how are you joyful when there's pain and suffering? And I finally said, I think one aspect of that is to live vividly during times of troubles is to stop asking the question, why is this happening to me?
Like last week's poem, I do not find it strange. Ruchiyama talked about being really, really, really sick. And he had a moment of being able to let go of resistance to it and be free from suffering. And he said, he wrote a poem about it and said, even if I should starve, I would not find it strange. It stuck with me. Anything else? Yeah.
I've been nominated against my wishes. I'm speaking as a representative under protest. However, I think our group kind of settled on the end that it's about, it doesn't matter what state of mind you're in, whether you're in a, you know, adrenaline-packed, excited moment or whether you're lying on a couch. It's being present to the moment and fully accepting of that without resistance. And I think Susan in particular, so it's everyday ordinary mind, and Susan, you know, really clarified it for me when she said that there was a time when she had her daughter staying with her and family, and she was very resistant to it. You know, I should be doing something else. But then when she took it on and embraced it, it became a very full being. So, yeah, I hope I've reflected everyone's thoughts on that. And
thank you.
I think that was generally, I've just summarized where we kind of came to was about being fully and accepting of the moment, whatever didn't have to be an emotional high or it's really accepting the situations as they arise in everyday life.
Thank you. All right. Do we have one more group? I guess our group, right? I don't know if anybody wants to say anything to summarize. Yesha or Shoketsu?
Yesha, you want to do it?
Well, let's see. I think Shoketsu shared, these may not be your exact words, forgive me, but feeling inspired and animated by listening to what other people were sharing in a way that she was inspired. And add some more of your own words, Shoketsu. And I said that I felt in flow and expansive, creative, more fluid, as opposed to being constricted and tight and bound. Also, there is more spontaneous. And any more words, Shoketsu?
Well, I'd say it's very interested, just really
very interested.
Interested in what's going on and what people are saying and what's happening, which seems counterintuitive to me to what's really going on out there, but maybe, I don't know. That's what it is.
I like it. All right, so I will just close with another ending little paragraph, which I thought was really, that summed it all up. By throwing our life force into our work, into our activity, every situation literally comes to life, and that in turn generates clarity and vividness. When the situation is full of life, we become more alive as a result. This means then that our life force has breathed a vividness into the situation. I feel very deeply that each of us must look clearly at this point for ourselves and then practice diligently with both our bodies and minds. So I will close with our dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for being here. Good night.
Good night.
Thank you.
Night.
Thank you, everyone.